Next case is 0482, disciplinary counsel versus William Medley. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, my name is George Johnson. I represent respondent William Medley. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. We have filed objections to the recommendations for penalty issued by the board. The hearing panel in this case recommended an 18-month suspension with 12 months stayed, resulting in 6 months time off for Judge Medley. The board modified that recommendation and has recommended an 18-month suspension with only 6 months stayed, resulting in 12 months off. The obvious reason, as stated in the board's report for the change, is first, Judge Medley's previous disciplinary matter, which resulted in a public reprimand, of which the hearing panel was obviously also aware. It's in the stipulations. And the second is Judge Medley's conduct before the hearing panel, also a matter that the hearing panel was intimately related with. There seem to be two areas of conduct that Judge Medley displayed at the hearing panel that are the cause for the increased recommendation by the board. First, with regard to count three, the board found that Judge Medley lied about the first order that was issued in that collection case. And second, with regard to count six, that Judge Medley has failed to accept responsibility that the collection procedure he implemented was unconstitutional. And I'd like to address those in the order that I just stated them. With regard to the collection case, as I'm sure the court knows from the record, a collection case was filed in small claims court by Holzer Hospital against a fellow named Roger Watson on April 15th, and his answer was due on May 15th. On June 11th, Holzer Hospital filed a stack of motions for default. Included among them was a motion for default in this case, and on that same day, Judge Medley signed the order granting default. That's on June 11th. On June 15th, Judge Medley puts on an order, which is on a form on which he's handwritten. Quote, defendant orally applied for relief from judgment pursuant to Rule 60B, motion granted and defendant given until July 15th to file answer, default judgment rescinded. There are two explanations for that order rescinding. One is an ex parte communication between Roger Watson and Judge Medley, where in essence it's alleged that Watson came to Medley, told Medley he wanted more time, that he didn't properly get service, and the judge granted it and put on this order. So that's what was found, that this was the result of an ex parte communication. The judge's reconstructed version, and the judge was relatively frank, as were all the rest of the witnesses, that their recollections of this situation, which was 4 years old at the time of the hearing, the recollection was very limited. Holzer Hospital filed about 3,000 cases of this same sort in Judge Medley's court between the time of these events and the time of the hearing. Doug Cowles, the lawyer for Holzer, clearly testified he didn't have a recollection. Explanation for this is the explanation that Judge Medley reconstructed, which was there was a telephone call which was not scheduled, in which Mr. Watson called the court while Holzer representatives and Holzer's lawyer were in the court on other Holzer matters, and the judge patched him in on a conference call. Watson said in that telephone conversation that he wasn't aware of the complaint, that his daughter had gotten it, and that the bill should have been submitted to workers' compensation. Now, Watson testifies that that is the first communication with the court. He can't put a date on it, but he says, my first communication with the court about these events was that telephone call. He doesn't say that he had an ex parte communication with the judge. He says it was a telephone call, and both of those things were discussed, that he didn't get the complaint and that he had a defense to not paying the bill. In his mind, the defense was that it should have been paid by his insurance. The judge remembers the same telephone call, can't testify about the date, but surmises that it was at this time frame. Doug Cowles has no recollection, the lawyer for Holzer. The representative of Holzer, Cindy Campbell, remembers the telephone call, but says she doesn't think it was in this time period because she was on vacation in Hawaii with her husband. The time period that Ms. Campbell is focusing on is June 11th, the date that the motion for default judgment was entered, and June 15th, the date that it was rescinded. What Judge Medley's reconstruction of these facts is that sometime between May 15th, when the answer was due, and June 11th, when the motion for default was filed, the telephone call occurred. So the recollection and the citations to the transcript have been included in both parties' briefs. The question before the court is, did the panel and the board have before it clear and convincing evidence that this first contact was an ex parte communication? Because that's the standard. If it wasn't clear and convincing evidence that this was an ex parte communication, even if it was equally likely that it was this telephone call, then there can't be a finding. It's critically important for two reasons. First, the distinguishing factor between this case and some other cases that were cited to the panel and the board is that in this case, the panel and the board found at least two ex parte communications. If the first one isn't established by clear and convincing evidence, then we have one ex parte communication, which puts it squarely in line with some other cases that this court has decided. And second, and most importantly, if there isn't clear and convincing evidence that the first communication was ex parte, then there is no evidence that Judge Medley lied. And that is the aggravating factor, I think, that this court will find that the full board hung its hat on in increasing the penalty. The second issue was Judge Medley's refusal to admit that his collection procedure was unconstitutional. This is an interesting situation. Judge Medley he's a municipal court judge. He has a small claims division, and he has inherited a procedure from his predecessor, which he researched and modified and implemented and was in place for a number of years. His procedure is based on Ohio Revised Code Section 1925.13. In the statute, I'm going to talk just about the statute for a minute. The municipal court judge is allowed to order a judgment paid at a certain date. He is allowed to order that the judgment be paid in equal weekly installments. And while either of those orders is in place and being complied with, if there's a payment schedule that's being complied with, he may protect the debtor from garnishment and attachment of real and personal property. So there's something in the statute for both the debtor and the creditor. Section B of that statute says that if within 30 days after the judgment is entered, there is no payment, the court then may, at the request of the creditor, issue a form to the debtor to fill out, which lists all of his assets, liabilities, and earnings, and require that that form be submitted to the court within 7 days, and put a note on the form that says if it's not submitted within 7 days, the debtor can be held in contempt of court. So Judge Medley's procedure based on this was as follows. He would issue an order that the judgment be paid within 30 days from the default judgment. These are all default judgments that we're talking about. And if it wasn't paid within 30 days, that the debtor was to appear in court approximately 10 days later. Certainly the date was fixed. The date and time were fixed on the form, but it depended on where it fell on days of the week. And what was to occur at that second hearing, if the judgment wasn't paid, was that the judge was going to establish a payment schedule. So obviously the intent was get the debtor before the court, figure out what the debtor can pay, enter into a realistic payment schedule, and give the debtor protection from the creditor from garnishment and attachment. That form also said failure to either pay the judgment in 30 days or appear in 40 days may result in the issuance of a bench warrant for your arrest. And if people didn't show up at that hearing to discuss a payment plan, they were in fact arrested and brought into court, and a payment plan was established or the judgment was paid. The bail on that contempt on the arrest warrant was often the amount of the judgment owed. Now, this procedure went on for several years. It was never appealed. There is no court of appeals opinion in Ohio that says this is incorrect. There was one occasion when a lawyer filed an extraordinary writ against another judge on the same court and the court as an entity seeking prohibition of this practice, but this court refused to decide that on the grounds of mootness. So there was never a finding that this was an incorrect procedure. Judge Medley testified that he researched it, Certainly, his conduct is related to the statute 1925.13 and to the court's inherent contempt powers. But we have a situation where he comes into a disciplinary proceeding and is penalized for failing to admit that his procedure is unconstitutional. If he believed it was unconstitutional, he shouldn't have been doing it. I mean, he researched it. He thought it was a reasonable interpretation of both this statute and his inherent contempt powers. And there was no court that ever told him legally that he was wrong. The place to decide these substantive issues of law is through the courts of appeal, and judges cannot be subject to discipline for the first time for making a wrong decision. So I think Judge Medley's refusal to admit before the hearing panel that his actions were unconstitutional is understandable. The disciplinary council has also appealed the full board's decision to find no violation as to count one, which is the sentencing. There was a misdemeanor defendant before the court for sentencing, and the judge read him the incorrect possible sentences, which was later the subject for appeal. Instead of informing the defendant what the legal maximum sentences were, the judge informed the defendant of what the maximum sentences that he would impose were. The defendant then, by himself, started giving some explanations about the concealed weapon charge that was filed against him, and the judge, sua sponte, dismissed that charge. The defendant pled guilty to the remaining charges, and the judge sentenced him. It sounds worse than it is. If you read the transcript, which is the first stipulated exhibit, you'll see that the judge did not initiate any sort of a plea bargaining conversation. The judge said, how do you want to plead? And the defendant said, well, with regard to this concealed weapon, I had a knife in the car for work. I didn't intend it to be a weapon. And the judge said, well, we're here to get a plea, and I'll dismiss that. I have no opposition to dismissing that count. And then the gentleman pled guilty. The things that are important about that count is that the city solicitor, the prosecutor in this county, in this city, is a part-time position. The city solicitor knows Doug Coles, who coincidentally is the same lawyer that represented Holzer Hospital in count six. The city solicitor knows that these arraignments are going on every morning, and he knows that if someone submits a guilty plea or no contest plea, that the judge is going to issue a sentence. The prosecutor, for manpower reasons, chooses not to appear. So the prosecutor had notice and chose not to appear. The judge certainly should not have given the sentences, the maximum sentences that he would impose, but as the Court of Appeals found, should have informed the defendant of the maximum legal sentences that he could impose, and that was corrected on appeal. I think the board correctly noted that to penalize Judge Medley for this kind of conduct, for what happened in this case, would put every municipal court judge and really every municipal court prosecutor at risk for disciplinary charges, because this is the way that business runs in these small jurisdictions. The prosecutor, I suppose, could have been charged with a disciplinary violation for failing to appear and do his job. But certainly they had a system worked out in that county that got these minor misdemeanor cases disposed of. And the judge did step over the line in this case that was corrected by the Court of Appeals. And we respectfully submit that the board's decision to find this conduct not to be a violation was appropriate. If there are no questions, I'll sit down until rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Caligiuri.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Joseph Caligiuri, Assistant Disciplinary Counsel for Relator. I would like to reserve 3 minutes in rebuttal. First, I would like to address respondent's argument concerning count three. Respondent's testimony before the hearing panel was dishonest. The panel members themselves asked the respondent 120 questions pertaining solely to count three. And they unanimously concluded, and the board agreed, and I quote, in short, The respondent lied. The respondent was presented with a choice at the hearing. He could accept the truth of his own journal entries, or he could fabricate a story. The problem was that if the respondent did accept the truth of his journal entries, then he admitted misconduct, and he was not willing to do that. So he fabricated a story. And that story was nothing but an attempt to avoid misconduct today. If you look at the respondent's journal entries in the Roger Watson case, they are not confusing. Exhibits 22, 29, and 31 portray a very clear picture of exactly what happened. And contrary to the respondent's argument, the panel found the testimony of the other witnesses to be clear and convincing. It was not confusing. But when you look at the journal entries, it's crystal clear. Every single time the respondent had an ex parte communication with Roger Watson, he removed a valid default judgment from the case. He did it on June 15, 1998, by journal entry. He did it again 4 years later. And the only thing separating the two ex parte communications was in 2002, Judge Medley actually knew exactly why Roger Watson needed that judgment lifted, because he was to inherit some money. He was inheriting property. There was a sheriff's sale, and he was to get proceeds. And that lien was precluding him from getting his money. So when he found out that there was a certificate, there was a lien against his money, he rushed down to the courthouse, and he told Judge Medley he needed that judgment off, and Judge Medley told him it will be off by evening. And he not only took off the judgment, he wrote out a journal entry that said, "I talked to Roger Watson and I took off the judgment." Classic ex parte communication. With respect to the small claims collections, that's count six, the panel and the board agreed again that the respondent's handling of the small claims actions was completely offensive and wholly inappropriate. The board concluded that the respondent was acting as the CEO of a collection agency, not as a judge. This is a common theme throughout respondent's career. He is simply not content being just a judge. Respondent's counsel would like this court to believe that Judge Medley spent 10 years researching this procedure. It wouldn't take 10 minutes to open up the revised code and look at section 1925.13. It lays out the very precise procedure that you have to follow when you have an uncooperative debtor.
I guess this raises the question, are judges subject to disciplinary action if they conduct themselves in a way that's later determined to be unconstitutional conduct?
I think in this instance, it is so fundamental that what Judge Medley is doing here that there could be no question of its unconstitutionality.
What would the standard be that we would write to advise judges that, be careful about acting unconstitutionally because you may be disciplined for it? We need to have a bright line, don't we? If we're gonna tell judges that they can be disciplined for a court telling them later that they've engaged in unconstitutional decision making?
Well, I think in this case, with all due respect, the statute is so abundantly clear that is the bright line. 1925.13 lays out the procedure, and the judge himself testified. He thought it was ludicrous. That was his word, ludicrous, that if a judgment creditor received a judgment, they had to wait and receive a 40-page pamphlet on how to collect the judgment. So he understood what he was doing. He knew how to expedite this process. He threw out the statute and the bright line. And he said, "I'm going to do it my own way. I'm going to issue arrest warrants, bring these people in, set the bail in the amount of the debt, and not let them out of jail until they pay it."
But we have statutes that are very, very clear on their face. And we have the substantial compliance or these tests that we've used to say, well, you don't really have to do it exactly the way the statute says. If you get close and you're complying with the sense of the statute, that's good enough. How is that different here?
And I would agree with that point wholeheartedly. The difference in this case is that even if you were to assume that Judge Medley did have the requisite authority to issue this process. He still abused the contempt process, which is what he's saying. It was his interpretation that he had this authority under contempt. He provided no notice. He provided no opportunity to be heard. These are just basic, fundamental things that every judge knows.
But why shouldn't we use the appellate process to deal with that rather than the disciplinary process? I mean, this is, you know, I read the fact pattern. I read their explanation of the judge's reasons and everything, and I thought, my God, this could apply in many, many situations. I think the chief is very right. It becomes a very gray line. Wouldn't the proper process to correct this behavior to be an appeal, and a court of appeals or our court eventually says this is an unconstitutional process rather than a disciplinary? This is judicial discretion. This is judicial immunity. I mean, could somebody civilly sue this judge for what he's doing and not have the defense of civil immunity or judicial immunity?
Well, I think that is one of the most disturbing parts about the reasons why Judge Medley engaged in this conduct. We're dealing with small claims court. We have creditors on one side, business owners in the community, and we have debtors who are down on their luck, citizens in the community. There, even the testimony at the hearing established, there is rarely an attorney involved in a small claims case. These people may not have the sophistication to know to appeal these types of sentences. The respondent would like you to believe that the fact that no one's complained is somehow mitigation.
But didn't at one point either a public defender or a legal aid attorney contest it? I mean, someone like that can file a class action.
That actually did happen on one single occasion where an attorney was involved. They did file a writ directly to the Supreme Court, and that practice stopped. But that wasn't the practice that we're here for today.
But I mean, just to say that nobody might have filed it doesn't sound like a good excuse.
Not saying it's an excuse.
The process is there. Do we say, well, we find the judge in violation because the cases are so small nobody may appeal it? That's what you're sort of arguing.
What I'm arguing is that the conduct on its face is misconduct. This is coming from a judge that has testified that he releases every single criminal defendant on their own recognizance. Yet he is going to haul in judgment debtors and set bail and not let them out of jail until they pay their debt. And in 10 years as a municipal court judge, he never conducted a contempt hearing because he didn't have to.
The judge says he never actually put anyone in jail for that reason.
Actually, what the judge said was that he never sentenced anyone to jail for failing to pay a fine. But he did testify that significant numbers of people were sent to jail via the arrest warrant and in jail until they paid the debt, i.e. posted their bond.
And if somebody has a summons to appear in court and they don't show, does the judge have the power to issue them arrest for the warrant?
I agree that the judge does have that power. The difference is that the standard is set in 1925-13 in small claims actions. This is how you do it. He didn't do it. He thought that it was too cumbersome, and he did it his own way using the arrest process. The fact of the matter is the judge did know the law. He ignored it. He testified that he thought it was ludicrous, the steps that judgment creditors had to go through. Let's just assume for a second that the judge had the authority to do what he did. He still is stepping off the bench and assuming the role of an advocate. This was totally driven by Judge Medley. The creditor only had to file a complaint. The statute clearly says if there is a default, then, in fact, the creditor must make application for this form listing the assets and liabilities. That didn't happen in Judge Medley's court. He was the advocate. He was the creditor. He was doing a favor. This is, as I said before, this is a classic theme. He simply cannot be satisfied being just a judge. He's either defense counsel, prosecutor, or creditor. Moving on to the relator's sole objection to the board's opinion, it comes to their dismissal of count one. Again, the panel unanimously concluded that the respondent committed misconduct. He misadvised the defendant as to the law. He conducted a universal plea bargain on the record. He engaged in an improper ex parte communication, all in the absence of the prosecutor. The panel and the board concluded.
Was the prosecutor, in fact, aware these were being conducted and chose not to appear?
No, the prosecutor was aware that arraignments were not being conducted. The prosecutor had no idea that plea bargains were being conducted, which is exactly what this
was. Had this ever happened before where a plea was concluded at the arraignment?
In Judge Medley's courtroom, he testified that this does happen routinely.
So the prosecutor then obviously had to be aware of it because the prosecutor's case would have gone away with a plea.
Not necessarily. As Mr. Coles, who's the assistant prosecutor in Gallipolis, testified, if his office isn't involved, there's nothing that would trigger his office's involvement.
Well, his office certainly would know that there's a complaint filed, and his office would know if the case was concluded by a plea. I mean, if he's not knowing that, he's not doing something in his job, even if he chose not to appear at the arraignment.
And the prosecutor may, in fact, know that a plea did happen. What he didn't know was that a plea bargain happened. A defendant could come in an arraignment and plead guilty to all the charges.
But the evidence is that the pleas had been taken before at arraignment. The prosecutor, if he was doing his job even halfway, had to know there were some pleas taken, chose not to appear at arraignments. Isn't there some sort of waiver on the prosecutor's part for choosing not to be at arraignments? I mean, this frankly is the first I've ever heard of prosecutors not being at arraignments.
Well, I think the fact of the matter is, again, the prosecutor didn't understand that pleas took place. He didn't understand that plea bargains took place.
And there, now you're into a gray line again versus pleas being taken and plea bargains being taken.
Whether the prosecutor was at the arraignment or not isn't the exact issue, because Judge Medley understood the limitations of the system. He knew that the prosecutor just didn't have the resources and the time to be at every arraignment, but he abused that system. He took it to the next level and stepped into the shoes of the prosecutor and started plea bargaining. The panel concluded and the board agreed that he was wearing three hats: judge, prosecutor, and defense attorney.
Counsel, the distinction here is a defendant can come in at arraignment and plead to the charge, the complaint, and the prosecutor would have no role at that point to object to a plea. However, if the judge, sua sponte, modifies the complaint or the charges, then the prosecutor certainly has a voice in what is happening. Here, the prosecutor had no voice and no expectation of a reduction of the charges sua sponte by the court.
That is exactly correct. The prosecutor himself had a right to be at the plea bargain, and he wasn't there. And therefore, this case should have never proceeded to a plea. The board dismissed count one. They stated that if we didn't allow judges to do this, it would clog up the system. But that reasoning has to fail. First of all, there was absolutely no testimony that other municipal court judges engage in the same type of misconduct. The only other municipal court judge that testified was Margaret Evans. And she stated, given the same fact situation, she would have simply sent this case over to the prosecutor. And second, even if we were to assume that other municipal courts engaged in this type of behavior, this court has a duty to not only sanction the respondent for his misconduct, but to put other municipal court judges on notice that plea bargaining by a judge will not be tolerated. And finally, this case created more work for the system. Brandon Jordan, after he pled guilty, hired a lawyer, filed a motion to withdraw the guilty plea, which the court denied, took it up on appeal, argued it, was reversed and remanded, came back, and entered another plea. If the respondent would have handled this matter correctly in the first place, we would have been done with this case in 1 to 2 court appearances without clogging up the system. But this was misconduct at every step of the proceeding. At arraignment, Judge Medley misadvised the defendant as to every possible maximum sentence that he was charged with. Judge Medley then took an arraignment proceeding to a plea bargain. Brandon Jordan was 18 years old. He was unsophisticated and he was from out of state. He asked the judge if he can do an unguilty on this case. Rather than recognize that he wanted to plead not guilty, the judge says, if you plead not guilty, you have to come back. And then Brandon Jordan starts explaining why he had a concealed weapon in his car. And the judge listened to him and he said, you know what? I don't have a problem throwing it out. And he dismissed it. This wasn't a guilty plea. It was a plea negotiation. And the respondent.
You've used your time, Mr. Caligiuri.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, you've saved about a minute and a half of your time.
With regard to the Roger Watson case, there's one landmark in that case that the court can rest on, and that is that after the judge put on the June 15, 1998 rescission of the default judgment entry, Holzer Hospital's lawyer did not react. If Medley had had an ex parte communication and put on this entry that said oral 60B motion, and it had been news to Holzer Hospital's lawyer, who had an office a block away from the courthouse and who responded negatively to the second motion for default judgment being rescinded, the order for default judgment being rescinded, you would have seen the same reaction. The reason he didn't file, he says he doesn't have any recollection of any of this. The reason he didn't file is because it's equally likely that he was involved in this telephone conversation and remembered, yeah, the judge gave him 30 days, and I included this motion for default judgment in the stack with 49 others. With regard to the small claims procedure, there's one thing that opposing counsel misses. You're not a judge by a cookbook. There isn't a statute that tells you how to do everything. A judge takes the law as he or she understands it and fashions procedures to run his or her court. And that's what Judge Medley did. He had a procedure that was a combination of Section 1925 and his contempt powers. And he, to say that he deviated from 1925 is not true. He based it on 1925, but that was not the sole basis of his procedure.
Let me ask you, you know Judge Medley's been sanctioned before by this court for conduct that if the board is correct on the ex parte issue here, count that's somewhat similar conduct. Why should we not impose the sanction that's recommended by the board, the more severe sanction, so that Judge Medley understands that his conduct as a judge is below the standard?
Three reasons. He is, first of all, he's a probate court judge now, so he is not handling these kinds of cases. Second, every single
witness.
Probably
a good thing.
I'm sorry?
It's probably a good thing.
It's probably. The second thing is that every single person who testified, including Doug Coles, who was a lawyer in the Holzer case and the prosecutor on the Jordan case, Findlay, who was a lawyer who came in to represent Watson later on, and every witness testified that Medley is always fair. He's not motivated by personal gain. He's not motivated by social contact. He's always fair. He's a good judge.
But a person can deny someone their rights in court and not benefit. I mean, a judge can certainly do that and not benefit the judge at all, but it can seriously harm the rights of parties, can it not?
That's true. And the reason that, and Judge Medley does wear too many hats. He did wear too many hats when he was on the municipal court bench. He had a tremendous docket. He knew everybody. And I think he did take the father knows best attitude sometimes. It was a small county. They were short on funds. He tried to get things done in a just way, and everybody's attribution of him as always being fair is a credit to that. It's a good thing that he's off the municipal court bench because he does have a tough time understanding that sometimes you just have to say, you know, I don't care if you've got funds or not, the prosecutor needs to be here, or I don't care if you're out of state, you've got to come back. But none of his conduct was self-motivated. None of it was black and white wrong. He tried to make his court run
efficiently. Well, if we believe that the board is correct or the panel is correct on the ex parte conduct, that's black and white wrong, is it not?
It is. If this court finds that the judge lied,
I know you disagree with the conclusions, but
I do. Yeah. But if he lied to the panel, then he deserves to be sanctioned. He didn't lie. There's no clear and convincing evidence that he lied. His testimony was, I don't have a clear recollection. I'm reconstructing this. I've listened to all these witnesses testify. I've looked at these exhibits. This is my best guess at how it turned out.
Counselor, was this a standard operating procedure to have an oral communication and then a judgment entry, the result of that?
No.
Was it testified by the judge that he did this routinely?
No.
So this is an isolated incident where a phone call precipitated a judgment entry?
The judge had Holzer folks in his courthouse on a weekly basis.
Right, and Mr. Watson just coincidentally called the chambers at the exact time that the Holzer people were in a pretrial on another matter?
What Watson testified to was that somebody from Medley's court called him, and the judge testified he didn't know anything about that, and Watson wouldn't identify the court personnel because he didn't want to get him in trouble, but somebody called and said,
hey, it's a good time. It's a good time for you to call
the
judge.
Good time for you to call in. He called in. The judge didn't call him up. The judge took the call with the Holzer Hospital people. So what we have is that I think the record, I think this court will conclude that the record shows that first telephone call happened with everybody. Cindy Campbell doesn't have any notes, but she doesn't have any notes of the call when it did happen. And the judge put on an entry that nobody objected to. Subsequently, Watson came into the courthouse, and the judge admitted it. He came into the courthouse. He's all steamed. He says, you gave me time to put on an answer, and now they've got a lien on my property. The judge says, I'll look into it. He gets the date screwed up. The judge has admitted to all that. Coles complained about that. He put on a motion and said, this is wrong. I wasn't present. You did something without me. The judge set it for a pretrial. So we have one ex parte contact, absolutely. That one was wrong, absolutely. But it's not a pattern. And the judge didn't lie about the first contact. And that's the breaking point, I think, in the sentencing decision that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Calgeri, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
There are four reasons why this court should impose the sanction recommended by the board, 18 months with 6 months' stay. Just 1 year before this complaint was filed, this court disciplined the respondent. In this case, he has committed multiple acts of misconduct, he's misrepresented his testimony, and he has refused to acknowledge the wrongful nature of his conduct. Relator urges this court to adopt the board's recommended sanction. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.